Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, here we go. Welcome back to the Gill Athletics Connections podcast. So humbled that you would once again press play. You know, as we are approaching past the 250 mark, I think this is episode 260 here. You know, all of us here at Gill, we're just super humbled that you would be here to listen to these amazing guests and for the amazing guests that keep coming back week after week. You know, it's a hard podcast to make. I ask for 2 hours of people's time, and that's hard no matter what it is. And during track season, it's even harder. So super grateful for all of our guests and for all of our listeners. Really do appreciate you all being here. So let's hop into it today. This is one I've been looking forward to for a while. You know, some people are just naturally born storytellers, and today's guest is exactly that. So I'm excited to get into, learn his history and hear some stories, because I think there's going to be some good ones. Help me welcome the head coach from the Wichita State Shockers in the great state of Kansas, Mr. Steve Raybould. Steve, how are you, sir?
Very well. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you. I'm really looking forward to this.
You know, the first question we have to ask that you need to explain, I guess, is the best way, because I think I kind of know the answer, is your mascot is one of the most peculiar question everybody asks. What is a Shocker? And then you see the mascot, which is a little bit of a scary mascot when you actually look at what the Shocker is made out of. Help us understand, what is a Shocker? Let's just take that off the table right here.
So you might think of a bale of hay. If it's a bale of hay, then it's referred to as a bale. Wheat is referred to as a shock. Mm-hmm. It's truly a shock of wheat. And that's just a bundle, so to speak, of wheat. And back when Wichita State was naming their mascot, or, you know, establishing their athletic department, there were lots of farm boys from the state of Kansas that shocked wheat in the summer for, you know, a summer job. Or heck, maybe they were from the farm and that was the family farm. And so they named it the Wheat Shockers. And back then, I think the Wheat Shockers was more common as a name. Obviously, it evolved and it's just the Shockers. And that is a little bundle of wheat that you see. And people always ask, is it a bumblebee or, you know, what is it? And it's wheat. And it's a little man made out of wheat. So anyway, we love it. It's been, like you say, interesting, and it's always a topic of conversation, and it makes me feel at home in the state of Kansas. I love Kansas. I'm born and raised Kansan. So yeah, that's what it is.
Well, I love unique mascots. I actually, one of my like little geekdoms in my head is I love college mascots and knowing what every school and their mascots are and things like that. And so the Shockers one is always cool because it's just it's unique. I don't know of another, not another Shocker, but any kind of like, you know, wheat-based, farm-based. I mean, there's a couple of like asparagus type things out there. There's a cool one in Arizona. That's a, what's that little fruit? Or a little vegetable. Anyway, but there's a couple of them out there, but Shockers is definitely, it's a unique one. And I love that. I really do.
What is the one that is the slugs?
Somewhere in California, maybe Riverside or Irvine, the banana slugs. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a unique one. My favorite one, we've done this a couple of times. Now we're going to play this game, Bolt. I told you, we don't really have a set agenda. We just kind of, you know, we'll go all over the place. My favorite trivia question is, name the college mascots that don't end in S. So Shockers ends in S. Most of them do, right? The Kansas State Wildcats, the Kansas Jayhawks, you know, there in your neck of the woods. But there's several that don't end in S. Can you think of any off the top of your head?
No, Cornhusker, you know, Sooner.
Yeah, they all in S. Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, my favorite answer is, I'm right here in Champaign, Illinois, the Fighting Illini.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sure. Probably the most famous one is Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish.
Sure.
Right. And then you have Syracuse, Orangemen. I think Harvard is the Crimson. Actually near you, Tulsa, the Golden Hurricane.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, that's a weird one as well, by the way. First of all, Golden Hurricane, it's, you know, no S on it, but why Hurricane in the middle of Oklahoma, for crying out loud? Yeah. It's always unique. I love it.
And that's not Hurricanes. Mm-mm. It's the Golden Hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. You know, I could go on. Tulane, the Green Wave, Alabama, Roll Tide. You know, it's all these different ones. Anyway, okay. But we're here to talk about you, not about trivia questions that are going to help you in your next Trivial Pursuit game. So, Steve, let's talk about your journey in this great sport. Somewhere, track and field had to start for you. You mentioned growing up in Kansas. Where does track and maybe other sports play into it when you're younger as well? But where does track start for you?
So I'm 10 years old, and I'm living in Prairie Village, Kansas, and feeding into the school system that's going to end up at Shawnee Mission East High School. And the Shawnee Mission East record holder was a guy named Randy Morgan in the high jump event. And his brother, Mitch Morgan, was a classmate of mine. I'm in the fifth grade. And I go over to Mitch's house, and there in the driveway is a high jump pit. It's summertime, and the high school coach had allowed Randy to bring the high jump pit home for the summer to practice, you know, in the driveway. You know, remember back then, it's the old straddle roll. So you could set the high jump pit off to the side of the driveway, and you're coming at it differently than we do now with the Fosbury flop. So with the curved approach and all that, so we begin playing immediately. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can do as a 10-year-old playing on the high jump pit. But I took pretty quickly to wanting to learn to high jump, jumping over the crossbar. And I went home and told my dad about it. So this is a little bit story. I'll try to make it quick. But in my science class, we were studying aerobics, the old Kenneth Cooper book, Aerobics. And he started the Kenneth Cooper Center in Dallas, Texas. And he was about health and wellness, and we were studying that. So part of that was a 12-minute run. So I would, my dad and I would go walk up to the high school track at Shawnee Mission East and jog or run for 12 minutes and test how far we could go. And laying there next to the sand pit, which was the long jump pit, was an old crossbar. And my dad had done some straddle rolling as a child in New Mexico, or as a high school kid in New Mexico. And he showed me how to do the old straddle roll. So remember, age 10, this is 1967, because I'm born in 57. And I took to it so quickly, meaning with regard to enjoying it and wanting to do it. Right quick, I would ride my bicycle up to the high school by myself, and I'd grab two hurdles and set them at either end of the sand pit and set that crossbar up there, and jump and roll into the sand pit, do a straddle roll in and roll out of it in the sand pit by myself. And I could do that for hours. One day, my dad shows up at home with the car full of foam rubber cubes of foam rubber and some folded up burlap. He created a big pillowcase of, and then stuffed the foam rubber in there. And we had a little high jump pit. And of course, for a 10-year-old, that was enough. It wasn't too long before I started bottoming that thing out, and we had to create a bigger high jump pit. But I had the ability to high jump in my backyard. My dad and I built, in my metal class in seventh grade, I built high jump standards. So, I mean, when I say I took to it, wow. I was a skinny, kind of weak, not very fast guy, but high jumping was something that I could do. And I just fell in love with it very quickly and got involved in the summer track program there in Johnson County, Kansas, you know, the Johnson County Parks and Recreation summer age group program. And I tried all the events. I tried shot putting, and I tried, you know, long jumping and hurdling and 400 meter running and you name it. But high jump was always the focus of my, you know, long-term love affair with track and field.
Give us a little bit of a history lesson here, Steve, on the high jump. Cause you know, it's interesting when you talked about your friend having the high jump pit in the driveway, you know, I'm sitting here in 2024. So I'm only thinking of the Fosbury flop, you know, the way we high jump down. And then you mentioned the roll and straddle and all this. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. We, you know, the high jump is actually kind of a new event the way we do it today. Walk us through, can you give us a little bit of history? So you were was everybody rolling at that point in 67 to call it 77, you know, through your say in high school for me, but through high school, was everybody doing that, or was there Fosbury? Because you mentioned an actual mat, which that actually kind of came in through the Fosbury flop, I believe.
So Fosbury himself in the state of Oregon, Fosbury flopped into sawdust, if you can imagine, which blows your mind to think about. But he started out being a scissor jumper, mm-hmm. and in an attempt to jump higher, just started kind of laying back a little bit, and so that he could elevate his hips a little bit, and scissored. But then he just naturally turned his back to the bar, mm-hmm. and I think he jumped, I don't know, 6'2" or 6'3" in high school. Anyway, he was burst onto prominence in 1968 with the Mexico City Olympic Games, jumped 7'4" and won the gold medal. And so this is right after I get going. And at that point, you start seeing some Fosbury flopping. But there was still mostly straddle rolling, a lot of straddle rolling. So then, you know, you mentioned 67 to 77. Yes, I graduate high school in 1975. I end up going to KU. I go on a recruiting visit
Stay in high school for me, because what I'm wondering with you is, so in high school, did you do a mix of the two styles, or did you go straight to Fosbury? That's what I'm wondering, your history on this.
No, I straddle rolled as a 10-year-old, as an 11-year-old, as a 12-year-old, and then as a 13-year-old, I began thinking, I feel like I'm not keeping up. I did real well as a 12-year-old. Actually, I did well as a 13-year-old. And then I guess it was when I was 14 that I was persuaded to try the flop, and I tried it, and it went okay that summer. You know, it's an interesting thing that this is making me think of. I can tell you what I jumped as a 10-year-old and what I jumped as an 11-year-old and as a 12-year-old and so forth, right on up. And I will ask some athletes right now. So remind me what your mark was, you know, 3 weeks ago at the, and they can't tell me. And I'm going, tell me what your mark was 3 weeks ago at the track meet at Nebraska. Right. Or at the track meet. Hey, seriously, would you like to tell you what I did?
As a 10-year-old?
Track and field championships as a 10-year-old? I can tell you what I jumped. I jumped 4'2" in the Greater City Track and Field Championships. I won the 9th division. I can't believe you're not able to tell me what you did three weeks ago. So anyway, that's a funny part of it.
Good.
But at age 14 is when I transitioned to the flop. And from that point forward, I was flopping. And it didn't go great that summer. I jumped 5'6" as a 13-year-old. And then I only jumped 5'8½" with the flop as a 14-year-old. And I was concerned that maybe I was, I don't know, stalling out or something. I was not going to get any better. But as a 15-year-old, I jumped 6'3" in my 10th grade year in high school track. And that was good. I mean, that wasn't great, but it was good. And I was pleased, and I was off and running. You know what I mean?
Because I'm trying to think of, like, because I'm trying to put myself in your coach's shoes. I can think of maybe one example. You can probably think of more. I can think of the glide to rotational in the shot put, but I'm trying to think, where in the world for track do we have to take one style and teach it the same event, teach it in a radically different style? So rolling to Fosbury, radically different, you know, in that shot example I gave, you know, glide to rotational, I might be overstating when I say radically different, but it's different. I can't think of another, like maybe a hitch in the long jump, maybe.
The pole vault, from steel pole vaulting to fiberglass pole vaulting.
Oh, yes, for sure. Right.
That was just a different world. I mean, it was a different, it changed the event radically. Now I do think there might've been some athletes that made that transition comfortably, but it was tough. I mean, that was a radical change.
That's a good one too. Yeah. The pole vault. So how did you and coach, were there ever struggles? Like, hey coach, I feel like I'm stalling out, I want to go back to the role. And coach is like, nope, this is the future, we're going to stick with the Fosbury. How was that relationship with high school coach?
Oh, it was, so by the time I got to high school in 10th grade, so remember, I'm old enough that it was junior high, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, and then high school, 10th, 11th, and 12th. So I wasn't in high school until 10th grade. And when I, by the time I got there, I was flopping. I was a Osprey flopper. But I had a coach in age group track. But, you know, age group track, there's 100 kids out there, and it's basically going from station to station. And I didn't feel like that I was being dictated to by a coach. I was kind of in charge of my own destiny, so to speak. And so it never was much of that kind of a thing. Heck, my dad was helping me at home as much as anything, and he was not knowledgeable. So he was real comfortable to work. He was just helping me. You know what I mean? We just basically playing around and having fun. So anyway, that was a comfortable transition for me.
Yeah, okay.
And once I found out that I could do it, you know, I jumped 6'3" as a 15-year-old, as a 10th grader, then off I went, and I did, and I was doing good. I jumped 6'6" as an 11th grader, and then 6'10" as a senior in high school, as a 17-year-old.
You know, to jump 6'10", jump 6'6" and above, is, you know, you got to be athletic. Were you doing other events as well, or any other sports, or just strictly high jump and track?
I was hurdling. So I had been a good little basketball player as a child, but I say child, like fifth grader, sixth grader, mm-hmm. seventh grade, then skinniness, and I guess you would say weakness, became more than you get banged around in there playing basketball. And if you're not a fairly stout young guy, you can get pushed around pretty easy. And I just wasn't as athletic. You know, I consider myself an athletic guy. I competed in the 1980 United States Olympic trials in the decathlon event. I consider myself an athletic guy. But at that age, I was underdeveloped and I was weak and skinny. And so I ended up really just taking to high jumping. And I ran cross country in the fall, but that was just for fun. I mean, I did it for fun. I say for fun. Obviously, I figured I was getting in shape for track. Right. Now I know better about that. Then that's the way to get in shape for high jumping. Right. But I love being out there with guys, and I ran cross country, you know? So.
Yeah. How does that 3 mile race help with 10 steps to the bar? Right. Yeah. It's like a little off there. All right. So senior year, you're jumping 6'10". You're thinking about college. Talk to us about where did you go, and tell us where, if at all, is coaching in your mind at all? Or are you thinking about becoming a doctor or an accountant? Tell us about that transition from high school.
Well, so first of all, that we were talking about the straddle roll. My host athlete at KU was a guy named Randy Smith, who was the final NCAA champion with the straddle roll event. I mean, the straddle roll technique in 1974. Yeah. He jumped 7'2" at Brigham Young in 1974, beat Dwight Stones in that competition, and won the NCAA championship with the straddle roll. So wow. Randy was something of an idol of mine, truly a guy that I looked up to immensely. Coach Pepin coached him. So then Coach Pepin was the assistant coach at Kansas back then, and he recruited me. You know, I've thought about this podcast. I've got unending stories. I could never give you a chance to even ask another question. I think I could literally take over right now and tell the end of the podcast.
The floor is yours, my friend.
But the bottom line is that I end up at KU, and I've got two U.S. Track and Field Coaches Association Hall of Famers as on the coaching staff. Bob Timmons is the head coach, and Gary Pepin is the assistant coach in charge of the jumps.
Yeah.
And it was epic. It was truly unbelievable. And I want to tell you something. I don't know why, how it is that God built me, but I knew it. I knew it then. I knew, man, this is awesome. This is spectacular. These are great coaches. You know, Timmy had coached Jim Ryan. And so I just knew, I mean, we held him in high regard. We had the utmost respect for Coach Timmons. And then Pep had NCAA champions, you know, the same year that Randy Smith won the NCAA championship in the high jump event. Danny C and Theo Hamilton went first and second in the long jump event at the NCAA meet. And I could go on and on and on about the accomplishments that young Gary Pepin had there as an assistant coach at Kansas. And so, you know, we could spend the rest of the time just talking about my experience at Kansas. It was remarkable. And I absolutely loved it, every moment of it. I'm the baby of my family. My sisters are 10 and 11 years older than me. And consistently, especially my oldest sister, Carolyn, would tell me, you know, hey, listen, buddy, you're in the first grade. This is unbelievably wonderful time of life. You need to enjoy elementary school because you're having a great time. She's in college at that point. Then I go to junior high and she's like, you know, that stuff about elementary school, forget about that, man. Junior high is the greatest. When you're in ninth grade, you rule the school, buddy. You're the top of the class there in the junior high. Then my senior year in high school, hey man, forget about all that stuff I told you before. Senior year in high school, this is where it's at. And then of course, college, she was like, listen, I've been lying to you all these years. You're getting ready to go to college, man. It's the greatest time of your life. And of course, by this time she's, you know, 20 something, late 20s, and she's out there banging around, being a school teacher and working hard and all that. And she's going, enjoy every minute of college. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you something. I woke up every single morning and enjoyed every single minute of college. And a big part of that was that I was on the track team at the University of Kansas. And I was giving thanks for that on the daily because it meant the world to me. It just absolutely meant the world to me. And Timmy and Coach Pepin were a huge part of that. Just a huge part of that.
I love reinforcement. So earlier this year or last year, we had Clifford Velto on the show, and he talked very much about Coach Timmons, Pep, that whole just how Coach Timmons ran his staff and his graduate assistants and what it meant for him and, you know, basically made Cliff what he is today and things like that. So it's really cool to see this really special time at Kansas with Coach Timmons and, you know, amazing athletes and coaches that came through that program. So it's cool to kind of hear that reinforcement from the athlete side for you as well.
Absolutely. Well, and you asked earlier, did I think about coaching?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes. I have no idea how or why, but literally as a junior high kid, I began thinking about coaching would be a pretty cool deal. And I literally ran into one of my old high school teammates at the KU Relays, oh, I don't know, 15 years ago. And he saw me and we shook hands and chatted. And he said, Bolt, I can't imagine you've been talking about wanting to be a coach since we were, you know, high school kids. And it's unbelievable. You've gotten to do what you wanted to do. This is awesome. And my dad was a hardworking guy. He didn't have a college degree. He went off to World War II before he had a chance to get a college degree. He flew 175 combat missions in the South Pacific and as an Air Force captain.
Wow.
And comes back and he starts working, man, and starts a family and raises us. And he had a good life. But when I got into coaching, he was like, Steve, you love what you do. That's revolutionary. That's revolutionary that you love what you do, because he didn't hate what he did. But it was work, man. He was a hardworking guy. And to see me able to coach track, are you kidding me? He was like, you're robbing a bank, man. How can you possibly manage this to make a living doing something that you love so much? So I knew every step of the way that I wanted to be a coach. And then once I got into coaching, it's really, really been a wonderful career path.
You know, I truly believe that everybody on earth is put on here to do one thing really excellently. Unfortunately, the vast majority of us, 95, maybe 99%, never actually find that. We become Air Force captains, and you know, maybe Dad was going to be the world's greatest artist, painter in the world, and just never had the opportunity to explore that. Right. So I love hearing, you know, this young Steve Rainbolt going, "Yeah, coaching. I think that's it." And then seeing it come out to fruition. You know, there's a lot of ways in the life that you could have gone on to have to do other things for a job, for work. So it's awesome to see, you know, this mix of passion, skill, and desire, and luck to find coaching in this profession. That's really cool. So
very fortunate.
If you had that as a young person, so really young, elementary school, were you different as a high school athlete? And what I mean by that is, you think about your teammates you had, did you pay attention to coach in a little different way? Like, well, why is he doing this type of workout? Why is he asking me to do this? Versus, you know, most of us as, you know, 14, 18 year old kids, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. And we just go do the workout and we're thinking about our history class and, you know, girls or boys, you know, were you different or were you just, okay, I'll just listen to coach and I'll figure out coaching one day?
No, I was definitely, I'm confident that I was definitely different. Mm-hmm. I was into it at a deep level. And, you know, it was a different time in terms of there's no internet. Okay. There's, right. I have no internet. I have no real way to do what one could do now.
Right.
With the internet. But there was track and field news. Hmm. There were journals. There were libraries with books. Aren't I calling out the name correctly? Peyton Jordan. One of the first books I got as a young kid at the library was a track and field book by Peyton Jordan. Wasn't he the great coach at like Stanford or
Stanford? Or, yeah.
He was at Stanford. Yeah. And I devoured that thing. I'm 11 years old.
You're supposed to be reading Fantastic Four or Spider-Man or something, and you're reading Peyton Jordan's book.
I mean, I can remember things from there that now I disagree with, you know what I mean? But that I read in that book and were early influences on me about how to do some of these events. Shawnee Mission East had a bunch of high jumpers, and I was one of the first. You know, Randy Morgan was a good high jumper, a multiple time state champion, the guy that I mentioned earlier that had the high jump pit. But after him, I broke his school record. And then after me, there were other high jumpers. Well, that was the result of Chuck Solzen, our coach. And he was not a high jump coach. He and I learned together. And he said that for years, that he had this young guy, Steve Rainbolt, who was really into it. And he just felt like he better, you know, he better bone up on the high jump and figure it out and help me. And he did. He helped me immensely. And he would meet me on a Saturday for a session. It was awesome. He was a great coach and he helped me immensely. And then he had a bunch of other coaches, I mean, athletes that ended up achieving at a high level in the high jump event.
I could see him thinking like, oh man, I better learn something. Cause this kid is not going to let it go. So I better learn something.
I was wearing him out. That's for sure. So I was into it that way. Very, very much for sure.
So you pick Kansas, you're a Jayhawk, you go there to high jump. What did you, and you knew you wanted to be a coach. So what did you major in? And you mentioned something I knew and I love to explore because it involves a common friend of ours, my former boss, my former mentor here at Gill, Fred Dixon. You mentioned you move on to a decathlon. So what did you major in at KU and how did other events start popping in to the rainbow high jump world?
So I go there as a high jumper. Oh my gosh. It's a interesting story. I was successful. I jumped 7 feet as a freshman. And then I jumped 7'2" as a sophomore. And at my sophomore year, I'm 19 years old. So I was high jumping. Well, it was going well. I won the Big Eight championship, my sophomore year and was going well, but I go to the, first of all, Jenner wins the Olympic gold medal in 1976 and sets the world record. That was a big deal, obviously. And I was very much aware of it and keenly interested in it, but I was not thinking about the decathlon at that point. So this is a quick story. Hopefully I can make it quick again. I go to the NCAA championships at the University of Illinois, my sophomore year, Champaign, Illinois for the NCAA in the old stadium. Not outside the stadium, in the old stadium. And, you know, you go to the NCAA championships, you show up there as a team for a week. I mean, you're there for the whole week. And I think the decathlon was maybe on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday, something like that. But the day after we get there, I go out to the track for a workout and the decathlon is going on. Well, two things. You go through track and field, and Bill Toomey runs 45.4 in the 400 meters and long jumps out over 26 feet. And you think, and then Rafer Johnson, you know, throws the shot put 60 feet or some such thing. And by all those guys were world-class at something. All those guys had world-class events. I think that Toomey's 400 would have gotten fourth place in the Olympic Games in the open 400. Guess what was different? Jenner. Jenner was different. He didn't have a single event that was great.
Right.
He had 10
really good,
good events.
Yeah.
And we all found out that he was unbelievably better than we thought because of probably the shot put, discus, and javelin,
right,
and 1500. But 6'8" in the high jump looked pretty manageable. Mm. 23.6 or 8 or whatever it was in the long jump looked pretty manageable. 47.9 looked pretty good in the 400, but normally the guy was a 49-second runner. I could go on. That the 14 mid looked pretty manageable in the high hurdles. And you started going, huh? A legion of American guys got into the decathlon because Jenner's marks looked man.
Right.
And so this is 1977 that I'm at Illinois. I go out and I'm watching the decathlon. And I'm seeing guys jump at 12 feet in the pole vault. Well, I pole vaulted in middle school in an age group track, like I told you earlier. And I thought, well, I can do that. And I'm watching guys throw 38 feet in the shot put. And I'm going, I shot putted when I was in age group track. I could do that. And I literally am starting to, it's the wheels are turning in my head. And then I it's time for me to go for a high jump practice. And I'm walking down the way toward the high jump for my practice session, you know, 2 days before the competition. And I'm pretty sure that I'm talking about Ron Livers. Old timers will remember a guy named Ron Livers, who was, by the way, I think about 5'10" or 5'11". I don't know, but not tall. And I'm 50 meters away and I'm watching him and he's walking toward the crossbar. And then he gets within about three steps of it and he goes, boom, 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 and bounces over the crossbar. And it was fairly unremarkable looking, but I thought, I wonder how high that bar is. And I keep walking and I get down there. And when I get down there, I check and it was 6'9". And I thought, you know, I'm not sure I can do that. I don't know that I can do that. That's a high bar to make a little, basically a little three-step pop-up and bounce over it like a boss. You know, it was remarkable. Huh. And in that same meet was the coming out party for Franklin Jacobs, who truly was something like 5'7" or 5'8" and jumped 7'7".
Wow.
And I'm watching this guy and I'm going, you know, I don't think I can do that. These guys are talented at a level that I'm not familiar with. And somehow the wheels had gotten turning about the decathlon. One thing leads to another. Another part of the story that I find very interesting, so I'll share it with you. 2 weeks later, I go to the U.S. Championships and the high jump event at UCLA, and the wheels had begun turning about the decathlon. I had begun thinking about this. And I get there, and Jenner is a commentator. He's a commentator for the event. And I think, I'd like to talk to him. And so I go and get in the autograph line and I get up there and I go, you know, I'm not here for an autograph. I'm here to talk to you about the decathlon. I know we only have a minute because there's a line here,
right,
but congratulations on winning the gold medal and setting the world record, you know. But I'd like to ask you how you got into it. And I was wondering if you have your training, if you have your training cataloged. And he said, absolutely. And he was very nice, great guy. And I chat with him and I go, well, could I get your workouts from you? I'd love to see how you trained. And he said, no problem. I'd be glad to send them to you. I go, well, son of a gun, let me get your address. And he goes, don't worry about it. Send it to Bruce Jenner, Malibu, California. It'll get to me.
That's a whole different level right there.
So I get a self-addressed stamped envelope and I send it to Bruce Jenner, Malibu, California. And
no way. Up in
weeks, here comes a packet back with his training, his handwritten training in it.
Wow.
It's remarkable. And I used a lot of stuff in there. I also met Russ Hodge at that meet. Got to be pretty old, probably, to remember Russ Hodge, but this was a stunning world-class specimen of a human. This was a remarkable athlete of the highest order, and I chatted with him, and he invited me over to his apartment. I went over there, and we talked, and we talked about the decathlon, and I started getting into the decathlon. So the next part of the story, you mentioned Fred, is truly interesting to me that because of today's world with these handheld devices that I'm holding in my hand right this second, and you know how we're all so connected. I read a track and field news article about Fred Dixon, because in 1977, Fred Dixon's ranked number one in the world in the decathlon, and he beat the Russians, and he had the second highest score in history behind Bruce Jenner of Americans, second highest American score in history. And there's a picture of him there in the track and field news interview. And he's a tall and slender guy like I am. And he's a Christian guy like I am. And he speaks of his faith in this article. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, you know, tall, slender guy just kind of caught my attention. And I thought, I'm back at KU by this time for my junior year. And I think I want to talk to this guy. And so I call information in Los Angeles, California. And, you know, there's a lot of Fred Dixons.
Sure.
And back then, they would only give you four at a time. So I'm writing down numbers. And then I don't reach him. I call four people. I don't reach him. I call back and I figure out how to get him to give me the next four. And son of a gun, at some point, fairly quickly, I reach Fred Dixon on the telephone, the world-class decathlon athlete. And we forge a lifelong friendship. And that was by me calling information in Los Angeles, California, and finding his phone number and calling him up.
Well, that, first of all, you know, I've known you and Fred and your history. I did not know that. That's amazing. You know, you think about, to your point about how connected we are today. And so you think the opposite, the antithesis of that is like, we were not connected. You know, we didn't have internet, cell phones, et cetera. Yet you were able to track down Fred Dixon in LA, by the way, not, you know, not Wichita, Kansas. Maybe there's only one there. And what I'm struck by really the most about that though, Bolt, is the persistence. So when you called in and they were like, yeah, dude, we've got 100 Fred Dixons in LA. Most people are going to be like, all right, this is needle in the haystack. I'll stop. I'll figure out something else. You persisted four at a time calling. Oh, you're not the cat. Okay. Thank you. Well, sorry to bother you. Click dial, dial, dial. By the way, you're paying for long distance calls here. We forget about this in today's 2024 world where we, you know, nothing, there is no charge for long distance, no roaming. He was paying like, you know, probably back then $1 a minute or something for every dial, but what I'm struck by there is that persistence. Where does that come from? That's not always an innate trait. Sometimes it is innate, but we have to have it modeled for us to actually to do it ourselves. Where does mom, dad, church, school, friends, where does persist? That is really the definition of persistence right there.
You know, I appreciate you saying that. And when I say I appreciate you saying that, it's flattering to me because I have thought that many times, and of course, I don't know, you understand what I'm saying. You don't sit around telling people how persistent you are, but I have thought about that many times when I've been coaching track and I've maybe had athletes that did not have much stick-to-itiveness or did not have much persistence that would indicate that they are going to find a way. Right. That's how I felt about it. But I truly go along and I think, but I didn't decide to be that way. I just was. I just was that way. It just is how God built me. And I can't answer exactly how it is, but I wanted to reach Fred Dixon. I could tell from reading the article that he would be a good guy. I just could tell. I want to meet this guy. And so I was determined to figure out a way to connect with him.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I've thought about this because I know our friendship with Fred and the connection that you and I have with Fred and all of that. I have a couple stories about Fred that just blow my mind and were, I don't know, influential in my life. You know, the story about Fred at the 1984 Olympic trials is truly remarkable. Are you aware of the story I'm talking about?
You know, he didn't talk much about 84. You know, I knew of 76 and the 76 Olympics, and we obviously all know, well, I should say obviously, most of us probably know about 1980 and the boycott and those kind of things. 84 was kind of a comeback year. He actually went out, my memory is went out of the sport, but came back in for 84, and I don't think it went well. Tell me your side there.
Okay, So try to make it quick. He's on the Olympic team with Jenner in 1976.
Right.
He hits a hurdle and stumbles badly in the high hurdle event and doesn't do as well as had anticipated. I mean, he was a gold medal contender. Yeah. He was a guy that was one of the contenders.
I'll tell you, just to add to that story. So when I first got to Gill and met Fred, and you immediately heard, you know, he was on the 76 and 80 teams, and I was like, oh, okay, obviously he was a stud, things like that. And then one day, and I'm so surprised, you'll be surprised that he's the one who actually sent this to me. Because he lived out in Oregon at the time when I was here in Champaign. And we used to use AOL Messenger back then. Now we have Teams and all that kind of stuff. But he messages me. He just sends me a YouTube link, and he's like, "Hey, I thought you might find this interesting." I'm a couple years into Gill now, so he knows my love and passion for what we're doing here in sport and everything. And it's the second day of I think the Pan Am Games. And so it goes through, the hurdles and all that kind of stuff. It's him and Jenner, you know, they go one and two. I think Jenner wins it or whatnot. But what struck me was at the end, the interviewer, he's got Jenner and Fred next to him. And he says, so I think it was 75. So he goes, so boys, you two are going to be, you're the hands down favorite for the gold medal. You know, how's this going to play out? And I knew Fred was good, but I never knew he was in the conversation of Jenner and gold medal. And, you know, so it really was like, oh my God, wait a minute, this guy, Fred, was athletically. And then, you know, I start, as we travel together and tell stories, I learn about the faith and not even being an athlete really, in the traditional sense and everything. So it just struck me, you know, where Fred, not only, I don't want to say where Fred was in the pantheon of decathlon, because history is history, where he is in the pantheon of decathlon.
Oh, so he's huge part of it.
Huge. Yeah. So sorry, go ahead. So,
So he's on the team with Jenner in 76. Then right. In 80, he makes the Olympic team. And, you know, by that time he had gotten into a program that was back then an Olympic assistance, you know, employment assistance deal. Right. I think it was with Bristol-Myers or something like that.
That's right. Yep.
And they would let him leave at noon. He could have basically what full-time pay for part-time work. He'd come in and then he'd go and train in the afternoon. And I was there at the 80 Olympic trials with, you know, I got to compete in the 80 Olympic trials with Fred. And anyway, he makes the team at the United States boycotts and he retires and he's done. He's got a family. He's 30 years old at that point. Yep. Back then, that was real old for decathlon guy for a track athlete. Right. And so he goes to work. I think he continued working for Bristol-Myers.
Yeah, yeah.
He just went, became a normal full-time employee and raising a family.
Right.
But the interesting thing about Fred was that he would, unlike most people that go jogging or go and lift weights at the gym, he would run 200s for his, you know, fitness activity.
Right.
His health and wellness plan was to run track and field workouts. Right. And truly he was not thinking, I don't believe at all, was not thinking about getting back into competing.
I think you're right.
Here comes 1984, and he's looking at the United States list of decathlon men, and he simply thinks, I think I could make the team again. I'm not sure, but what I couldn't do it again. Because the things were not unbelievably high level.
Right.
There were no unbelievably high level guys. There were a bunch of good guys, right, but not unbelievably high level. And so he goes to Bristol Myers. Could I go back to training again for a year? And he does. And he goes to the Olympic trials in 1980. And he no heights in the pole vault. First of all, he no marks in the discus. And that was an unbelievable story. I mean, to bring tears to my eyes to tell the story. He's leading the decathlon after day one, has a fabulous hurdle race. And on the second event of the second day, the discus event, he fouls his first two throws. And man, he goes for it on his third attempt and throws a discus further than he'd ever thrown it in his life and can't stay in. And so he's got three fouls and basically decathlon over, but he goes ahead and pole vaults. And I think he might have no-heighted the vault, if I'm not mistaken, but it doesn't matter. The decathlon was over. Yeah. And then he goes and throws the javelin. And at that point, that year, there were so many decathlon guys. It looks like it's like 8 o'clock in the evening or seven.
Is this when he leaves?
He leaves the state.
Who's my guy at Liberty? Just retired a few years ago.
Yes. I'm trying.
He told me the story because he coached the kid. Yeah. Okay. Keep going. All right. I do know this. This is so unbelievable. This is character.
Unbelievable story. And so Fred, it's going to be 4 hours till he's going to run the 1500. Mm-hmm. Plus he doesn't like the 1500. That's his least favorite event that there is. Yep. And he thinks, you know, I'm done here. It's over. I am not going to make the Olympic team. My decathlon is over. And he lived, you know, an hour away there in the Los Angeles area. So he and his wife get in the car and head home. His children are at home and he's feeling broken, beat up, frustrated that he, you know, no marked the discus, and he drives home and literally an hour later pulls onto his street and is driving down the street almost home and looks at his wife and says, I don't think I can tell my kids that I didn't finish my last decathlon. And turns around and drives the hour back to the stadium and runs the 1500. Mm-hmm. And I love that stuff, man. Are you kidding me? That's what it's all about.
It's easy to say, don't live a life with regrets. Don't do things that you'll regret later. And then there is action. And that's what Fred took there. It was like, oh man, if I do this 10, 20, 30 years, I'm going to have to tell my kids, yeah, I quit. Yeah, I quit. But you know, and then give every excuse in the world. Oh, but it didn't matter. I was already out, yada, yada. No. Here's the story he gets to tell now. Hey, you know what? I'm going to finish no matter what. I'm turning back around. And I did it. Wow.
That meant the world to me. Yeah. And when I say that, it was stunning to me. And so that guy has been a man that I've looked up to since I got into decathlon. And I was a college track athlete when I met him. I've gone to his house for Thanksgiving before. He and I have been very good friends, and I've really loved my lifelong friendship with Fred Dixon.
Love it.
So anyway, that's a story that I was glad you mentioned Fred, because I wanted to tell that story even before this podcast. I thought of that story because of our friendship with Fred that we share. And so anyhow, I'm glad I got to share that.
I love it. So the decathlon becomes like a thing in the back of your head from the 76 Olympics and then the 77 NCAAs, which I love, that was right here at University of Illinois. Was that the same? Because I think U of I held nationals a couple of years. Was that the same year Don Page did the 8:15? Yeah. I tell you, you know, this is going to be a podcast of stories now, but one of my top three experiences in track and field, I wasn't there for that. I was like 1 year old, so I wasn't there for that. But Don Page came to Champaign. I think he was working on the University of Illinois outdoor facilities a few years ago, right before COVID. And I've gotten, you know, so blessed to be able to know Don and have a friendship with him. We go to a restaurant to have dinner that night. So we're in Champaign, and I've always heard the story of the 8:15 double, but I've never heard it from him. So I get the guy who did it to start telling me the story. And it was kind of striking. It was a beautiful night. You know, we're sitting outside having dinner and having a drink. And I got the guy who did it telling me the story. And then he drops the bomb, because I did not know this. He goes, yeah, so it was right here in Champaign. It was at the Memorial Stadium when the track was around the football stadium. I had no clue that it actually happened in right here in Champaign. So then it really hit me like, holy cow, I'm at the place where it happened with the guy who did it telling me this. It's phenomenal. You know, he talks about how, you know, the story of Gags and how Gags coached him and mentally as well as physically. It was just phenomenal. So I love the history right here in Champaign, and forget that we held nationals for a couple of years there. Okay. So this decathlon's in the back, this little bug is growing. You get it. Did you start doing it at KU, or is this a post KU thing? And
no,
how did Coach Timmons and the rest of the staff, Coach Pepin, how did they take that? Was it, I mean, I had to assume that it was, well, I don't know, you're giving a face now. I was going to say, I have to assume that it was supportive, because it ended up being very successful. What was that like? Hey, Coach, I know I'm doing well in the high jump, but I want to just throw it all to the wind and let's do 9 more events.
So it was not well received. Those guys, to their credit, I am so thankful. They hung in there with me and worked with me. I mean, now I'm a, 30-year head coach at the NCAA Division I level, and guy comes and tells you he wants to quit doing the event that he's been. I say quit. I mean, I was still planning on jumping well, but won the Big 8 and jumped 7'2" in 1977 as a sophomore at 172 pounds. Now I'm going to get a little bit stronger and bigger and more powerful and try to do the decathlon, and I ended up at 192 pounds. And I never jumped quite the same. I still jumped good, but I never jumped quite the same. So I got second in the Big 8 my freshman year, indoors and outdoors. Then I got first indoors as a sophomore and third.
In the high jump you're talking about.
Event and third outdoors. Now, you got to remember, there was no decathlon in conference championship competition back then.
Oh.
So I'm giving up jumping as well.
Oh,
as I
wow.
For an event that is only at the NCAA meet. It's not the conference meet. And those guys care desperately about the conference meet.
Wow.
So I can't believe that they were as gracious and wonderful as they were. And they pushed back, don't misunderstand. But I really wanted to do it. And it affected my scholarship. I was on a smaller scholarship after that, because I basically was abandoning. After that, I got fourth 3 times in a row in the high jump event. And that was the only event that I was good enough to compete in the Big 8 conference. So anyway, that's an answer to that question.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But then I went out and I, after college.
Hold on there. I want to. That made me think of something, because, you know, I'm not just very coach focused. I'm 100% coach focused, even to the detriment. I don't think of athletes all that much. I think of the coaches, so that the coaches can affect the athletes. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned in this podcast has been the catalyst to help me learn this. I was lucky to have Brooks Johnson and George Williams separately on the podcast. And, you know, Brooks, when I had Brooks on early in the podcast, you know, 4 years ago now, he brought up George Williams's saying of, if you're not in the huddle, you don't know the play. And it really affected me, because I really work and strive very hard not to judge others for everything. A guy cuts me off, I try not to, what'd you cut me off for? It's like, oh man, that guy may have just gotten the worst news. I don't know. So it really helped me, you know, had like words for it. And then I had George Williams on the show 2 years ago, I think, from St. Augustine's, and got to talk about, you know, where he came up with that phrase and why and things like that. So what you just talked about there, Bolt, that made me think of that, because first of all, I was thinking in the shoes of the coach, okay, I have this guaranteed first, second place, because it's not, you're not doing this in your freshman year. You're doing this after your junior year. So I got this guaranteed with Rainbow high jump. I'm going to get 10, 8, 6. I'm going to get in that range of points. That's awesome. And conference is huge. And he's going to nationals now, you know, he's doing those things now in his last year to 2 years here, he wants to switch to the decathlon, you know, so I'm giving up. I'm definitely taking something that I'm called guaranteed. We know in any event, especially the high jump, there's no guarantees, but I'm giving up this really high probability of getting a lot of points in this one event. And I was thinking, to maybe get some points in decathlon. But to your point, there wasn't even a decathlon. So now the coach is like even more like, why? There's no motivation here for me. I have investment, money, and time spent into this kid for high jump, and I have no reason to move here. unbelievably to me, the coaches do this, but then what really, so here I'm getting at with the, if you're not in the huddle, you don't know the play. I wonder how many athletes, coaches, maybe friends, family, et cetera, start seeing your senior year, you're getting fourth. And it's like, oh, it looks like he probably had some senioritis. Oh, he's not taking it as serious. And in reality, it's like, oh, you're actually setting up something pretty special. I don't know that you would have or could have, I don't know, went to the Olympic trials in the high jump, but you eventually, you made it to the Olympic trials in the decathlon. That's, I don't care if you made it or not. That is unbelievable talent. Every kid who makes it to the Olympic trials, boy, you are a freak of nature. You are unbelievable. So it just made me think of that. If you're not in the huddle, so a lot of people from the outside had no idea you were training for the decathlon and start seeing, you know, air quotes here, subpar high jumping, subpar for you, and judged. And it really, that just makes me think for guys and gals that are listening, coaches, athletes that are listening, when you see an athlete doing not as good as you think they should be doing, by the way, you don't know what's going on. Here it's a positive. Like sometimes it's, you know, family members pass away or, you know, health issues, et cetera. This is a positive. He was training for, you know, 9 other events here for the decathlon. I just wanted to point that out. That just really stuck with me when you talked about where you started going in the high jump, but what was ultimately being built, and people from the outside had no clue what was going on.
It's exactly the way that it went. What you just said, you know, I weighed more, I weighed 192, you know, I jumped 6.75 in one of those conference championships. Now it was good enough for fourth that day, but that was below my standard, man. Even though I was focused on the decathlon, that was demoralizing to not have a good conference championship. I cared deeply about doing well in the Big Eight conference championship. I wanted to do well. So what you're saying is exactly right, but those guys hung with me. And at some point they were able to see that amazing, good things were happening. I scored, you know, on the old table, 7,719 at the Kansas relays my senior year. And then, which turned into, you know, 7,600 even, on the new tables, and got to go to the Olympic trials and the decathlon. Obviously I knew I wanted to coach, but that was not anything in my thinking when I took it up. But oh my gosh, what a wonderful, you know, lesson. It was just a wealth of lessons. It was unending lessons that I learned for my coaching. When I've got an assistant coach and it's the throws coach, now I know what he's going through. I know about the throws, and I know about the hurdles, and I know about the sprints, and I know about the jumps. You know what I mean? I've experienced all that stuff. And if I had only had the background of the high jump, it would have been fine. I think I'd have been okay coach, but you understand what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. I agree with that. Cause what I was hoping you weren't going to say is because you had the actual experience of doing them, that's why I know the events. Cause I don't believe that's true. And it's been proven there's plenty of coaches out there that never did their events that are unbelievable, but you're right. It made it easier because you had the personal experience. But I think a guy like you would have, take away the decal. You know, this story starts and ends with the high jump. I think today you're still talking about, oh, I love the throws and really work hard to make sure I know what's going on over there because of your passion for the sport as well. Yeah. So you're right. I think it makes it easier having the experience, but it's definitely not the roadblock to coaching those.
Oh, events. No, it was, but I value all of my experiences, as a head coach, I value that I had those experiences, right, and I have a sense for what those young people are going through.
Right.
You know, I have been so fortunate. I mentioned Timmy and Pep, and then after college, I want to try to go and compete at a high level. And I go out to Santa Barbara and got to train with Sam Adams. Yeah. And That was to this day in no uncertain terms. All three of those guys, Coach Timmons, Coach Pepin, and then of course, now I'm talking about Sam Adams. The time I spent with him influences what I do on a daily basis out here at track practice. It influences what I do every day. I think of the things he said. I think of the ways that he demonstrated. I think of one of the things I took from Sam is I was injured and he goes, well, it might be a blessing in disguise maybe that'll be a blessing in disguise. In other words, I was a hardworking athlete. An injury was going to force me to back off. It was going to force me to freshen up and to let my body heal up after a hard bout of training while my injury was healing up. And so he made the cut, and it was the first time I'd ever thought of that. Gosh, maybe this time off or this time where I'm limited will be a blessing in disguise. And I talk to athletes about that all the time, The influence that Sam had on me was immense. And the guys that I trained with out there, there were five of us that had been in the Olympic trials in 1980. And then a whole bunch of college guys that Sam had on his UCSB team. Right. And so it was a cool deal. It gave me a sense of a decathlon camp. And then Jane Frederick was there, and I got to be real good friends with Jane Frederick. And again, a lot of younger folks might not know who Jane is, but she was the Jackie Joyner Kersee before Jackie Joyner Kersee. I mean, she was the U.S.'s best ever multi-event woman until Jackie.
That's a tough one to be right before, because most people say it starts and ends with JJK for sure.
That's a tough one. She was really good.
So where is, because you're out of college now, so where is coaching? Are you full-time athlete, part-time working? Are you coaching at all? Where is coaching at?
I got an injury out there in Santa Barbara. I got a sciatic nerve aggravation that effectively ended my career, or I would have been glad to be a track bum for a long time. I would have been glad to ride that wave as long as I could ride it. Right. But the injury stopped me, and I'm really struggling with it. And Coach Pepin he was the head women's coach. He was with us at Kansas my whole 5 years. And then right at the end of my 5 years, he goes and becomes the head women's coach at Nebraska. And then in 1983, they combined the programs. Frank Savine retired from Nebraska, and they combined the programs and make Coach Pepin the director of both men and women. And he calls me up and hires me to be his assistant. And what a wonderful time I had there at Nebraska.
What's that like? I've said, and I still believe this, that for graduate assistants, I think there should be a rule that you cannot be a graduate assistant at where you did your undergrad in. I just think, I hate to say it's impossible, but it's impossible to go from hanging out with your buddies on Friday and then your coach so-and-so on Monday. This seems similar-esque. And what I mean by that is, how did you go from, because I know Gary Pepin, what an amazing guy, what an amazing coach. I don't want to say strong personality necessarily, but he has his style. You were coached by him. How do you transition from, and there's separation there. There's years separation, which obviously helps. I think obviously helps. How do you go from being his athlete to now being his assistant coach? Like, how do you not defer of like, oh, anything he says is, he's still the head coach, so there's a little bit of it. But, you go from listening, him barking orders of the workout to, hey, you have a group to go coach. I've hired you to coach. Go coach.
I tell you what, you're 100% correct it was difficult. But I didn't think of it as difficult at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of it as difficult looking back, because he's a Bearcat, man. That guy's a tough rascal, I can tell you. He was something else to work with. But I had the benefit of being very close to him. Mm. So he could get frustrated with me. I could get frustrated with him. I could be ruminating and it eating me alive. And I knew all I needed to do was go over to his house and spend an evening with him, because that's what I used to do as an athlete. And clear the air. And sometimes it didn't even have anything to do with actively clearing the air about whatever we'd been upset about. It was just spending the evening together. And when we did, we always cleared the air and felt good. He and I are like really close friends. And we were when I was an athlete on the team at Kansas. I mean, he helped me so much. He was really wonderful. But it was difficult. The way you're talking, it was difficult to go and coach for him. But a big part of that was because of him. He's a tough guy, man. Right. He is a taskmaster and expects excellence in the pursuit of track and field achievement.
Right.
And so now, was that a great training ground? Yep. It was an unbelievable training ground. He was a recruiting wizard. He just worked his tail off at recruiting. And it certainly, you know, influenced me in my coaching career to really value hard work in the recruiting in order to build a program.
Oh,
and I mean, I learned so much from Coach Pepin. So, and here's the other part of that. Lincoln, Nebraska is a great place, man. It's a wonderful place to live. The Big Red Machine, especially back then, was a really special situation. That athletic department is a special athletic department. And so there were so many major positives, you know, that it was only a positive in my memory. It was wonderful.
So this is your first full-time coaching job. What you know, it's one thing to want to be a coach. It's one, if since fifth grade, it's one thing to you prepare yourself through education, through talking with your coaches, through paying attention to your own training, things like that. Now you've actually got to direct other young people. How did that transition go for you?
It went well. I mean, when I say it went well, I loved it every step of the way. However, I will say that that first year, I got to work with Angie Thacker, who ended up fourth in the Olympic Games in the long jump event. And she was NCAA indoor champion. And a girl named Heather Smith, who was third in the NCAA as a true freshman in the high jump. And a guy named Darren Burton, who was a 7'6" high jumper. I mean, that first year, I got to work with some great.
I was about to say, wait a minute. How do you handle that? You're still a young person, and this is your first coaching job. Some of us coach forever and don't have that caliber. How did you handle that? That's some stress and pressure, right? Like, don't screw these kids up.
Well, my first year, we won the NCAA indoor at Syracuse in women's track. The girls, Merle Naughty and Janet Burke and Angela Thacker, went 1, 2, 3 in the – well, I guess back then it was the 55-meter dash.
Yes, I didn't know that was this, yeah.
And so that was my first year on the staff, and so it was a very heady time. I mean, it was some significant track and field, obviously, and a really, really special time. But, you know, I don't know, Mike. I was at Kansas, and we had great athletes. That part of it didn't overwhelm me.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It didn't overwhelm me too much.
Yeah.
I tell you that I can remember sitting there and shaking hands with Angie after she wins that NCAA long jump and giving her a fist pump and really excited. And then sitting back in my chair and thinking, well, I'd rather be competing. But remember, I had been competing 1 year previous.
Right.
Previous, I was still dreaming of being an Olympic decathlon athlete.
Yeah.
And that was hard. So that part of the transition was hard.
That's a good point about your background at KU and then going on to Olympic trials. So you're around other, you know, high level athletes and not being intimidated. Some of that intimidation, I think, comes from what's the term I want to say here? Like lack of self-confidence, because, you know, you've coached long enough now and you've coached great athletes in a lot of different events. But, you know, the difference using women's long jump as an example, the difference between coaching a 21, 22 foot women long jumper is not all that different. There's going to be a lot of don't hate email me. Everybody who's listening, you can tweet me, but don't hate email me here. There's not a lot of difference between a 22 footer and an 18 footer, or even a 17 footer. There are differences, but it's not like you do some kind of special workouts for a 21, 22 footer that you just do different maybe intensities or volumes for the 17, or you maybe focus on more technique and you're still focused on technique on a 22 footer. So, but I think sometimes, I don't want to say young coaches, but coaches who get in that first, you know, amazing athlete or get into a program where there's several of them, there's a little bit like, oh, well, I better do more, or I better do extra, or I better do whatever that extra 1% workout that I haven't learned because I haven't gotten to the club yet. But now I coach a 22 footer, so I'm in the club. And that's not true.
Hey, listen, what you're saying is exactly right. There's no question about it. I've always felt exactly the way you're talking. You know, so many times I've really enjoyed coaching women's track and field. And I've had success coaching women's track and field. And I've had lots of people say, obviously, you know, coaches and others, obviously it's way different coaching women than men. And I've always thought, yeah, I don't feel like I do almost anything differently for anybody, whether, like you're saying, for a lower level jumper or multi-eventer or a higher level multi-eventer. I am a fairly simple-minded guy, I guess, that way. And in the case of Angie, at the outset, I made the comment, I worked with Angie. I was the jumps coach and I worked with her in the long jump, but I don't even use the word coach because she was a sprinter who came over to the long jump once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. And she had a significant knee problem and she literally didn't jump in practice. We literally didn't do almost even pop-ups.
Yeah.
Now she would, we would occasionally do pop-ups at the end of an approach. But do you know what we worked on? Her approach. That's approach. She could sprint without too much knee pain. And then she'd jump at the meet. So I coached her at the track meets and I coached her in practice. And I was real eager and young. And so I was doing everything I could to figure out how to help her master her approach.
You came around to something it's hard for me to say this to you, Bolt, to correct you on, because originally you started out, you said, hey, I said I worked with her. And then you explained, you know, cause you didn't get to do what you would traditionally do with a call it a full-time long jumper. However, in my mind, you know, now having, you know, I'm an old man now here, Bolt. I've, you know, 30 years in this sport and coaching and on this side, seeing way more about coaches and what they do. That is coaching. Coaching isn't just, I have a full-time long jumper, so we do approach work and pop-ups and, you know, speed work, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes coaching is knowing when, hey, you know what? I can't do those things. Thank goodness she can do the sprint workouts and she works with Coach Pepin on that or whatever. Bad coaching would be, well, we're long jumping, so I'm sorry your knee hurts, but we've got to pop up to do this. That's the only way to be successful as a long jumper. That's bad coaching. Good coaching, not just working with someone, is, hey, we're going to take it easy here. We're going to get everything we can out of you, but that means we're not going to be able to do pop-ups or, you know, this other type of jump workouts, et cetera. So you came around the end because you said, yeah, I coached her, but I coached her in a limited bit. That's coaching, man. That's the cerebral, the whole side of coaching, not just I took her from 0 to 100. So bravo that you understood that. Bravo that you had people that helped you understand that as well. Like, hey, man, we're not going to be able to do these things with her. We still can win if you don't do those things with her. That's the crazy part. We can still win if you don't do those things with her.
You had to keep your eye on the ultimate prize. Right. You're right. And that is get her to the track meet. Have her at the track. And I have many times, and this is not to be insulting to any coaches at all, but I have many times said that it seems like, in the way you're talking, that some coaches are writing workouts in such a way as to justify their existence. Mm-hmm. I mean, on many days, rest on this day is what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Rest needs to happen today. And maybe rest needs to happen for the whole Thanksgiving break. And so that 4 days, in fact, let's build it in from September 1, we're planning that rest is going to happen. Absolutely. Over Thanksgiving, because we're going to have a good hard training, you know, cycle and lead up to that point. And then let's back off and give you a chance, to rest and recuperate.
Yeah.
You don't have to write a workout for that day just to justify the fact that you're a coach. You know, you can,
you know what I think that comes. I'd love to hear your opinion on this, where I think that sometimes comes from, I think you're right. Sometimes it does come from, you're describing it coming from the ego side. I have to justify that I'm a coach. So we're going to work out hell or high water. Your body feels, I don't care. We're going to do this, right? If we rest all week, well, what am I here for, type of thing? That's an ego side. I actually think the majority of that, because I see that a lot, I'm with you on this. I think coming from this side of the table here, so, you know, I have a different view of it. It might not be the right view, but so I'd love to get your take on this. I think it comes from fear of judgment. You know, I think about, I love convention. I love the Thursday night at the in the lobby of the hotel when coaches gather. I love when we are all talking and we're trading stories and we're trading workouts and we're trading experiences. I love, like, that's the kind of thing I wish I could capture on the podcast, actually, because that's the real culture of coaching. But I think sometimes we get caught up in, oh man, that coach coached, you know, we use the, keep using the women's long jump here. That coach coached a 22 footer last year. Boy, how silly am I going to look when I say, hey, you know, for my 20 footer, we actually didn't work out over Thanksgiving because of what, I can't say that. So I better make sure we do work. I think there's a fear of judgment in coaching. And that is where I do think the connectivity of today, the social media, cell phone, et cetera, gets caught up, because we post a lot of workouts and a lot of, you know, my kid just won this, my kid just set this PR, and you're sitting there looking at it going, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me? Why aren't my kids PRing every day? Or why isn't she PR'd? Or why haven't we done this? And it's like, well, I guess I better do more workouts. And the access to workouts is incredible today compared to even 10 years ago. I think the fear of judgment drives some of that sometimes, instead of being confident in your skin, confident in your curiosity to what other coaches are doing, but knowing that your athlete and your situation, your school, your program, et cetera, is vastly different from every other program out there. So you're going to have to do things differently.
I agree with you 100%. You've got to try to tailor it to your situation and to the academics, the academic calendar and the academic schedule and your meet schedule, and learn what works, you know, in your system.
Yep.
And go with it.
And your location, your facilities, your age and stage of coaching. I mean, Bolt, where you are today, we're talking about Nebraska right now, where you had, you know, a lot of success and coached some really amazing athletes and performances. Would you say you're a different coach today? And what I mean, when I say different, evolve, like you're even better today than you were back then?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you've heard the old phrase, you know, that old coach has forgotten more than those coaches will ever know. Mm-hmm. And I used to think that was a cute, you know, old saying or something. And now I go, no, that's not a cute old saying. That's a legitimate remark. I have forgotten more than some young coaches might know. And how do I know that? Because every now and then I hear about something that some young coach is doing and I go, son of a gun, I used to do that. I'd forgotten about that. That's pretty good. I need to do that again. That was really good. I used to do that. Yeah, but I do think that the reason that I have set aside some of those old things is because I've learned and I've learned what works, and I've zeroed in on, I've crystallized my thinking down to the things that work, and then eliminated the things that don't work. Right. And so, yes, I'd like to think that I'm a better coach now than I was before. Absolutely.
It's a hard thing to do. To when you're talking about workouts and even what you can get out of the kids or not. I remember, you know, when I coached, I don't know if we still use, I haven't heard this terminology too much in the last decade or so, but back then we used to talk about with sprinters, float, sprint, float. I think it's more of a, you said that, Bolt. I have literally forgotten everything. I've forgotten more than you'll ever know, because I have forgotten all of it, man. I'm out of practice, dog. So there's no, I just forget everything. See, now I'm trying, not max velocity. What's that? Speed endurance. So I think that was kind of a speed endurance workout, but I could never, by the way I was taught it, I could never get the kid. I actually couldn't understand it, how a kid's supposed to go from 100% and then freewheel, you know, the float part, you know, 95% and then back up to 100. I was like, I just can't concept that. So I can't teach the kids. So I just took it out. All the big dogs were talking about it. And I was like, must be dumb. I just can't do it. So luckily I was smart enough that I just didn't do it. I was like, all right, we're just not going to do it. I can't figure it out. So, but that's hard, because the ego, I mean, I had a lot of big coaches that were like, yeah, we float, sprint, float. And I'm like, yeah. Why? I don't know how to do this thing. So but that's hard. That's where confidence has to come in. But also with a dose of humility to continue learning as well. So, okay. You're at Nebraska. How long at Nebraska and where to next?
So 7 years at Nebraska, and then Bill Byrne was the athletic director at Nebraska, and he left there, if I'm not mistaken, went to Texas A&M, but I went and talked to him about, you know, if I want to be a head coach, tell me what I need to do. Tell me what steps I need to take in order to be a head coach. And he said, well, you need head coaching experience. You need to go get some head coaching experience. And it has appeared to me that that has changed over the years a little bit, because I know, but back then I will tell you that he was right. There were very few assistant coaches that rose to head coaching positions back then. It seemed like, at least not directly. It was kind of, maybe they did within a program, but to move to a upper level significant head job was very difficult. And in today's world, more of that has happened. More coaches have moved from good programs as assistant coaches to head jobs. But anyway, I heard about the Kent State University head job. I knew nothing about Kent State. I didn't know about the Mid-American Conference. I didn't know about the field house there at Kent State, you know, nice 300 meter oversized indoor track. But I heard about that when I heard about the job, and it caught my attention. I'd been in the Big Eight and kind of the, what referred to in today's world as the Power Five level. That's the level that I had been at in college and at Nebraska. And I just wasn't familiar with the Mid-American. Well, I found out, man, that was a heck of a conference. You know, that Eastern Michigan group with Bob Parks and then the Western Michigan, there was some good track and field in that league, man. That was a heck of a conference. And anything below, I say below, at any level that is not what we're now referring to as the Power Five, which back then we referred to as 1A, stuff like that, Eastern Michigan has to be in the conversation for, you know, greatest non-Power Five track and field operation in history.
Yeah.
So does Lou Hartzog's old Southern Illinois teams. Those were unbelievable. And it's something that I have aspired to here at Wichita State, to have a program that is thought of as one of the, you know, top, as one of the top programs at this level, so to speak.
Yeah. It is interesting. If you don't know the history, I love that you brought up Carbondale's program, because I remember one time I was teaching a level one and someone else teaching was from Carbondale back in those days. And he was a 7'2", 7'4" high jumper. And I was like, oh, wow, Carbondale. He's like, oh yeah, I think I was second on my team in high jump. He's like, I had a better guy. He goes, and then we also had, you know, this, you know, 300 foot javelin thrower and the 4x4 team ran. And I was like, wait a minute, Carbondale? Cause you know, I get caught in the trap of it. You know, it's only LSU, Florida State, USC, Georgia, you know, I get caught in that same trap that we always get into. That's why I do love, like right now, Northern Arizona specifically, like, man, I love that. I just absolutely love that. So you mentioned you're in the MAC. I totally forgot about that. What was your last year in the MAC? What season?
So it was the year 2000. It was the spring of 2000.
Okay.
I came here in the summer of 2000.
Got it. So you left Kent. I came to Ball State for the 2002 and 2003 season. So we just missed each other. But I remember that. I totally forgot about that. Now I remember that. And I agree with you. And I spent 2 years in that conference. And I was just talking to someone, it might have been Wendell, actually, you know, who, speaking of Kent State, what a bunch of great coaches we had. And we still do in the conference. I'm talking about when we were there, just killers as coaches. I mean, it was a tough conference meet. I always distinctly remember the throws specifically, but sprints, distance, you're right, with Bob's team, Sue Parks put together an unbelievable squad there at Ball State. It was an amazing time. Miami of Ohio, Akron. I mean, it really was unbelievable during that time. How did you like, you know, I didn't think about, you know, I was going to ask you about the, you know, coaching in the Big Eight, you know, big school, things like that. I totally forget you also went to school at Big Eight. So you just knew kind of Big Eight. That was your, you know, your whole livelihood there. How did you, I'm going to say handle, how did you adjust? That's a better term. How did you adjust to the mid-major? You know, there is differences, budget, travel, expectations, caliber of athlete that you can attract initially out of high school, et cetera. How did you adjust to that level?
So I don't know that I've got a great answer to that question, but I will tell you this is that as a matter of regular routine, it didn't occur to me very much. And what I mean is track practice out here is just like track practice was at Nebraska. And it's just like track practice was at KU and like track practice was at Kent State. And now, when did I notice? I noticed, and I mean, this is a transparent conversation. I noticed at the NCAA meet, at the NCAA meet, I would be less than honest if I didn't admit that I noticed the guys, you know, my old staff mates walking around with a Nebraska jacket on, or the other guys and gals walking around with the SEC jackets on and the Big Ten jackets on and the Big Eight and big, and then obviously real quick after that, it was the Big 12 jackets on. And I get it. I would notice. And then literally on my way back to Kent, I'm back engaged with Kent State track and field. I'm back engaged with trying to win the Mid-American. It didn't really bother me a bit. Now, budget was something, but I was not the head coach at Nebraska, so budget concerns was not my thing.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that at Nebraska, we were, that was the early 90s, and we were more careful about budget than I think the really, really well-to-do Big Ten and SEC programs are now.
Yeah.
We were not spending money like water back then. We were spending money. I mean, we had a premier program, and we were spending money, but not like they do now.
Yeah, Big Ten Network changed the game, I think. Yeah,
not even close. And when I say that, I got to Kent, and I'm the head coach, and I'm watching over the budget, but it didn't occur to me. We made a spring trip to California. Yeah. We ate some peanut butter sandwiches, and had four in a room so that we could make a trip, so that we could be out there for a week. And we watched our pennies, but it was good. It was great. I didn't think of it too much.
Okay. My favorite question. I ask this of everybody on the podcast when they get their first head coaching job, because you don't know, to your point, you made a great point there. You're like, as the assistant in Nebraska, Pep ran everything. So I was told what I could spend or not spend, et cetera. But now when you get the head job, you never know what, I think a lot of assistants think they know the head coaching job, but you never know until you are sitting at that desk and have those responsibilities. So I'm always curious. I got two questions for you. The first one is, when you got the head job at Kent State, what did you think was going to be hard that ended up being easy for you? So think about fundraising, budgeting, making a schedule, doling out where scholarship money, there's the whole purview of head coaching. There's a lot that you have to do. You may have to go speak at the Kiwanis Club now because you're the head coach, things like that. What did you come in thinking, I might struggle here, but as you got into it, it was like, oh, okay, actually I picked that up pretty easy. That wasn't as hard as I thought it might be.
So I suppose I was probably nervous or whatever. I really don't remember being particularly nervous. I felt reasonably confident that I knew what I was doing, but I was now going to be recruiting, or at least monitoring and watching over the recruiting of an entire track and field operation instead of just an event area, And so that was something that I was wanting to figure out. I don't know that I was wildly nervous about it, but I was wanting to make sure I got to figure out how to do this, philosophy about scholarship expenditures. But I enjoyed that. I enjoyed figuring out how to distribute scholarship money. And I feel like that we have figured it out. I was figuring it out at Kent State as a head coach, and I have refined it here at Wichita State. And I feel like we have a good system for distributing scholarship money. And that was something that, was significant right away. And then scheduling is always an annual challenge to figure out all of the nuances of putting together a nice meet schedule. You know what I mean? So I suppose that one was challenging a little bit, because I'm going in there and I'm thinking, well, I got to figure out how much this budget will allow me to do. And so you kind of got to sit down and immediately come up with some sort of but the good news was that out there in Ohio, man, there's lots of good track and field nearby. You don't have to drive far.
Right.
That whole Mid-American Conference was within a 3-hour drive or something like, you know what I mean? Now they, once they added Buffalo, that was a little more of a drive, but not much. Yeah. It wasn't that much more of a drive. And so I loved that. I loved that regional feel.
You were in the, if I remember my history, you were in the thick of it in the MAC, especially near the end at the 2000 time, where we were dropping a lot of men's programs. And that continued, unfortunately. When I was at Ball State, we dropped the men's program. Now they're, you know, the MAC is, you know, it's a pittance of itself. Yeah. It's a great women's conference. It's unbelievable. It's actually quite impressive what the men do, considering there's only four teams out there. How did you navigate those waters? As you just think about us dropping men's programs and the MAC was just devastated as we were trying to become the next BCS football conference there in the MAC, which is just ludicrous. How did you handle and navigate any concerns that were maybe coming up at Kent?
You might be right. We might have dropped some, but really, even all the way up until I left, it was still 8-9 teams on the men. And because I feel like it happened in one big fell swoop, all of a sudden they dropped 4 or 5 programs and it was down to 4 or 5 teams, I think. And that was right after I got to Wichita State, somewhere early on in the 2000s.
Right. Yeah.
And so I didn't feel it. I don't remember feeling that.
But
oh my gosh, I love being at Kent State. That's a great place. You know, I'm a Kansan, and so this was a lateral move professionally to go from Kent State to Wichita State. The Missouri Valley that we were in when I got here was similar to the Mid-American. The budget here was similar to the budget at Kent. I could go on. It was over and over and over. The athletic department was a similar kind of an athletic department, other than that we don't have football here. But the bottom line is that this was something of a lateral move professionally. But I loved, the reason I did that was because it was get back home, get back closer to home. And we host the state high school championship. I competed right out here behind me in the state high school championship as a high school athlete, and it's meaningful to me. It means a lot. And so I thought this was great that I would come.
Did you think, and I appreciate you moving it forward, because for the sake of time, I have a billion other questions I want to make sure we get in. So I appreciate you moving it forward here to Wichita. Did you move to Wichita? I get the family and the connections, and totally didn't even think about you competed on that facility. That's quite, I love that kind of closed loop there. I really do love that. Did you go there thinking, I'm assuming at this age and stage, Bolt, that you're going to retire from Wichita State? I could be wrong. That's an assumption here. But did you go there thinking, yeah, this is going to be the last job to retirement? Or it was like, oh, no, I'm going to go back home and we'll see.
I probably did not think that this would be the final one, but I was open to it.
Right.
All along, I've been open to staying here forever. But in the interest of transparency, my alma mater would have always been a dream job. That would have been a dream job.
Sure.
And I enjoyed my time in Lincoln, Nebraska so much that that would have been something of a dream job.
Sure.
But at some point, you know, I'm 66 years old. At some point, probably somewhere around 60, I started thinking, well, this is a great place. This has been a wonderful place. I've thought that every step of the way. So don't misunderstand. There have been a couple of dream jobs, but other than that, I've been a happy camper here for 24 years. I've been here 24 years.
That's amazing.
It's been a great place, community, a great athletic department. You know, men's basketball was in the Final Four in 2013. And so we rode a pretty terrific wave for a long time of upper level basketball success. Obviously I mentioned that because that translated into athletic department success,
right?
You know, it was a wonderful time to be a Shocker, and it still is a wonderful time to be a Shocker. We've got a fabulous athletic director that I'm really enjoying working with, and senior women's administrator and all of that. And so this place has been a wonderful career path spot for me.
So let's talk more about Washington State. Sorry, WSU was on my head. Wichita State. You mentioned you don't have football. You've been at places that have all had football, some at very high levels, Nebraska, some at, we want to be at high level, so we're going to tank the athletic departments. I'm not specifically mentioning Kent State there, kind of the MAC in general there. And now you're at a place that doesn't have football. Do you think, because you know, you've been at different places, you obviously, you know, have friends that are all different gamuts that have football and don't have football. Is this a benefit for you as the track coach, or is this a detriment as the track coach?
From my perspective, it's a major benefit that we don't have football. And I will tell you that when I was in the Missouri Valley, I haven't heard this comment in quite a while, but when I was in the Missouri Valley, I would hear some of our opponents at other Valley schools, you know, cry the blues a little bit that, geez, not having football is a huge advantage for you guys, because, you know, a football Saturday is a wonderful, is a wonderful day for people, for athletes, for the community, for whatever. But other than those six Saturdays, it's an army of football players running around an athletic department using up tons of the resources. And thankfully at Nebraska, the Big Red Machine was such that that wasn't too bad for us. We certainly understood the hierarchies of college athletics. Football was the mother load, but we still had a wonderful situation. We had good facilities and we were well financed with budget and all that. So it didn't harm us. But I will tell you that both at KU as an athlete, you know, I have recollections of my two Hall of Fame coaches having a football manager come down to the stadium in the middle of track practice and go, "Coach, football team's coming down today. They didn't think they were going to, but they're on the way. You're going to have to leave." And we'd have to leave.
Wow.
And it didn't happen very often. You know, I love KU and all that, but it happened multiple times, and it made you feel like a second-class citizen. And I didn't like that. And at Kent State, that beautiful field house, I can remember at the other end of the field house was, you know, garage door. And a rainy day outside, that garage door would open up and here would come the helmets and shoulder pads. And we knew that track practice was getting ready to be over. But like I would tell the athletes, "Hey guys, this is frustrating. I get it. We get kicked out when they come in, but you know what? It's three or four or five times a year. We'll survive it. Come on. This is not that big of a deal."
Yeah.
Now I was trying to put a positive spin on something that was pretty pretty frustrating.
Yeah.
But it was true. It wasn't that big of a deal. That athletic department was wonderful and all that. But my point is that football, I never found it to be spectacular to have a football program. Now, the occasional sprinter, right. You know what I mean? Or the occasional thrower. Okay, that was great. But I've not missed it here.
Yeah.
I just haven't. It not compared to the benefits of not having a football program.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Earlier, you mentioned when you got to Kent State and you had to start learning and put into play, you know, your recruiting dollar distribution. And, you know, one of the things that has been really awesome to watch, I knew about them when I got to Ball State. I knew about them from your Kent State days. And now, you know, watching for the past 20 plus years here at Wichita State, a Steve Rainbolt led team is always going to be a team. You don't load up the sprints and hurdles and have a bad cross country team. You guys are almost like your decathlon. You guys are solid across the board here. And then you'll have those superior athletes that you guys coach up to. How have you at Wichita State, because you've been through different conferences and that changes things. And you've had people come into conferences and lead conferences. That changes how you recruit. I remember when I was at Mississippi State, we were a 12-team conference. And I remember I left right before Missouri and Texas A&M came in, but I was like, "Oh man, that would change your recruiting, you know, less walk-ons and things like that, because you got two more good teams." And now with Oklahoma and Texas coming in, oh my God, that's going to change up how they do things tremendously now with 16 teams. Your conference meet looks different at 16 teams as it does 12, et cetera. How have you navigated different conferences that kind of, you know, that's a mix that you can't, you have no control over that. How have you continued to evolve and amplify that recruiting dollar distribution that you do?
Balance and depth. You said it. Balance and depth is the hallmark of our focus. It's what we're going to try to accomplish. We've always tried hard for balance and depth, and we try to distribute our scholarship money accordingly. The first time that we ever sort of questioned that philosophy in our scholarship distribution system was when we went in the American and Houston's sprint group was otherworldly. I mean, one of those years in there, I felt like, well, this group has to be in the conversation for greatest sprint group in the history of collegiate track.
They were putting like seven in the finals of the 100 and stuff like that. You're right. They weren't just they were good nationally and really good conference wise as well. I remember this. Yeah. It was ridiculous. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievably tough. And that year that I'm talking about, they set the collegiate record in the 4x1, if I'm not mistaken. They set some sort of a world record in the indoor 4x4. And they had a national champion in a sprint race. Anyway, I'm thinking just by those two relay accomplishments, they have to be in the conversation for best sprint group in the history of collegiate track. Mm-hmm. They got to be in the conversation when you have mm-hmm. the collegiate record in the 4x1 mm-hmm. and some sort of, I say some sort of, because I always get confused about world records, like indoors.
Right.
International athletes. And they set some sort of a world record indoors in the 4x4. And so anyway, it made us question, and only question it made us think was, well, okay, we'll keep recruiting sprinters, but they got to be good enough, or else why invest scholarship money?
Because you're staring at that 7 of 8 in the finals, and not only, but it's also not a blip, because you're like, oh, well, their focus isn't going to change off of that. So it's not like, oh, we just have to bear through this for a year or two, let these kids graduate, and then things get back to air quotes normal. It's like, oh man, as long as that staff is there, by the way, they've held that staff all the way through. What am I doing? Why that? This comes with a question mark that diminishes the value of the money that you're spending on a kid, not the kid, but the money you're spending on that time. Cause it's like, man, 1060, that's awesome. Would love to have you. Won't even make the finals.
No.
Yeah. Right.
Way to go before you make the final. Yeah. Now I will say that you mentioned 7 of 8 in the final. That's true. And the 8th one was a Wichita State kid.
Yeah. There you go.
And I was proud of that. And absolutely. So we have scored in a bunch of the sprint events, but it, you know, we're scoring a guy or maybe in the 400 hurdles, 2 or 3 guys, or the high hurdles, 2 or 3 guys. And we've had some scoring in the 400, but it's hard, man. Yeah. It's harder not to get out. It is not easy. And so,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want you to continue actually what you're saying there. You said you started to question it. So what was the answer then? As you guys started kind of question it, what was the answer? Persevere, change? What did you do?
Well, also stick with our foundational principles, which is distribute scholarship money based on contribution to the team effort at American Athletic Conference championship meet competition. That's how we're going to distribute scholarship money. Well, that creates some guardrails for you, because you know that you have to be good enough in order to get up in that final in order to deserve very much scholarship money. Mm-hmm. Now, we might still give a small scholarship to an athlete that's not good enough and then hope that they develop. And certainly we're hoping and thinking that they'll be on our 4x1 and things like that. But the other option would be build a 4x1 off of long jumpers and 400 meter runners and high hurdlers and such like that. And score points in those events. And by the way, we've won the last two outdoor conference championships.
Amazing.
And I'm really proud of that. It's a difficult part of the conversation because so proud of it. That Houston operation is premier and one of the terrific track and field operations in America. And I am so impressed with them. And it meant the world to me as a coach and to our program, to our athletes, to win those two conference titles. It absolutely meant the world to us. And I love those guys on the staff down there at Houston. Absolutely. And so bottom line, that's been, when I say that it's a difficult part of the conversation, what I mean is that I'm at risk of acting like that those two championships have meant more to me than the other 33 that we've won during my time here.
Right.
Cause we've won 35 team titles here, and they've every single one of them been super meaningful and a major celebration and all of that. These two have been special. Yeah. There's no way around it. It's just a fact, you know.
Winning is hard. And I think we get spoiled in track because we have, you know, 21, 22, whatever the number of events are. So every meet we go to, there's a winner. Where in football, you know, there's one winner, baseball, one winner, et cetera. So I think we get spoiled sometimes. Winning is hard. So whether you're winning the individual event or winning a team title, that's hard. Whether you're in the Missouri Valley, the D3 California Institute, it don't matter. You're up against other people who are also wanting to bury you. It's hard. So every one of those championships, no doubt, I get exactly where you're coming from. And in the face of a daunting, you know, what Houston has put together, I can see where it's like, oh man, everything had to go perfect. You know, we had to go perfect, and we needed a mistake to happen maybe. And guess what? We persevered through that. I love that. All right, two more questions here to wrap us up here, Bolt. One is, I'd like for you to tell us, because you do something really unique. I only know about it a little bit from the outside, from social media and stuff. You know, there's no way we could do this podcast without mentioning the word golf with you. Tell us about this. I don't know if it's a fundraiser for the track program or if you do it for charity. Tell us about this annual, just crazy thing you do on the golf course.
Well, so... I mean, there's a little bit of a backstory. I'll try to make it quick. You know, I'm a fitness oriented guy. I'm a health and wellness guy. I was a physical education major, and I've always cared about health and wellness. And I enjoy fitness. I enjoyed running after I was done with being a competitive athlete. I enjoyed getting out for a run. And as I was approaching 30, I believe, approaching 30, I thought, you know, I'm going to do a marathon. When I turn 30, that'll be a birthday challenge. It'll be a challenge for me to do. And I started training for it. I ran a half marathon. Somewhere along the line, I got sick, like a bad cold or something, and it sidelined me, and I got sidetracked and I didn't do it. Age 40, I'm approaching 40, and I start thinking the same way. I'm going to do a marathon, and I get sidetracked and I don't do it. So I'm approaching 50 and I'm thinking, you know, I haven't ever accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. I'm going to do it this time. I'm going to get up there and I'm going to do something at my 50th birthday. Well, I think of a 50 miler. I think I'm going to go 50 miles. That's what I'm going to do.
Wait a minute. What in the world are you thinking? You could,
I know it's
26.2. So you say, well, I'll just double it.
So I talked with one of my athletes, one of my former athletes from Nebraska. She was an All-American 400 on the 4x4 relay, and she had done some ultra marathons. And I go, hey, Jenny, I'm thinking about running a 50 miler when I turn 50. And she goes, Coach, don't do that.
Oh, thank you, Jenny. Thank you.
She goes, yeah, you shouldn't do that. I don't want you to do that.
You shouldn't do
that. And I'm like, really? I was thinking I'd like to train for it and, you know, get ready and do it. And she's like, yeah, sorry, don't do that. And I go, okay, what about 50 kilometers? And she goes, that would be more manageable. You can do that. That's, you know, 31 miles. That's 31 miles. So I come to the office, and in order to like commit myself, I tell the staff, we're going to do a fundraiser. I'm going to be a one-man jogathon, and I'm going to cover 50 kilometers and do it on my 50th birthday. Bottom line, I did it. We sent out flyers. It was a fun event. Did it on the indoor track, if you can imagine.
No way. You ran 31 miles on the indoor track.
Yes, which is really weird. But
dude,
anyway.
So how bad did you feel after?
I was hurting.
Yeah.
My legs were demon possessed.
Oh, boy.
Because, you know, I'm a big guy. And I was not ready for ultra marathoning. I covered the distance. Now I did some walking. I did quite a bit of walking.
Sure.
Well, anyway, at that point I wasn't going to do it again, but age 55 starts coming and I think, you know what? I think I'll do it again. So I did it again. I went 55 kilometers. That was 34.1 miles. Did it right out here on this track. And that was really stupid. That was really not smart because I was hurting so bad. Well, the athletes are playing ultimate frisbee on the infield. The music is going. We turn it into an event. And at 14 miles, I've got 20 miles to go. At 14 miles, I think, I don't think I can keep going. I'm hurting here. I'm struggling. And I think, how far do I have to go? Wait a minute. I've got 20 miles to go. It was daunting. But I walked most of that. Like from that point forward, I was walking. But I made it. I made it in 8 hours and 20 minutes. And so then I was into golf. And you mentioned golf. And I was playing golf with a doctor in Kansas City that I randomly got, you know, connected up with. They placed me with him. And we're talking about steps on our, you know, Garmin watches and stuff. And he tells me that every year, he's a doctor, every year he goes out one day and plays the number of holes that he is alive. So at this point, he was probably about 68, and he would go out and he would turn it into a little fundraiser. He'd send out pledge forms to his buddies and raise money for the Heart Association. He was a doctor, you know, or something like that.
Right.
And I thought, son of a gun, that's something I'm not going to run anymore because now I've got two total knee replacements.
Learn that lesson.
Replacements because of these stupid choices. But anyway, I decided that's a pretty good plan. I could walk. And this was when I was 57. So the first year I did it, I was 57 years old and I walked 57 holes of golf. And I probably covered about 23 miles on foot, but I was walking and playing golf and enjoying it. And we turned it into an event for Shocker Track and Field. And we turned it into a fundraiser and raised a fair amount of money. People would pledge by the hole or they would pledge by the stroke or you name it. You know what I'm saying? So then I start doing it every year as an annual challenge. And I did it for 9 consecutive years. And this past year was the first year that I didn't do it. I had a little heart incident in August.
Oh.
By October, when I was usually doing it, I just was not feeling ready. I didn't feel in shape for it. And I actually had a wrist injury and one thing or another, I didn't feel like I could do it, but I intend to get back to it. I enjoy it and it's fun. It's hard by the end of the day, but it's not near as hard as those running activities.
So what was the last one? 64, 65?
No. 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65. 65 was the last one.
So what's the math? So 18 holes, right? So 36, 72. So it's just under 4 full
That's
rounds.
Right.
How long does that take you? Is this like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m.?
Yeah. Here's the deal is that I can't do it in the summer when it's a long day because it's too hot.
Sure.
And I won't last in the heat.
Sure.
So I got to figure out how I can get as close to cool conditions,
right?
But with cool conditions are shorter days. And so I'm looking at late October, right around 1st of November. And at that point, I've got like 10 hours and 30 minutes of daylight. And I have to calculate 66 holes and how many minutes per hole I have to make it. And it's only like 11 minutes per hole. And I gotta keep moving.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do you carry your own bags or?
Oh, I put my bag on a cart, on a drive cart, and I just walk.
Okay.
And somebody, what you might say, caddy for me.
Caddy, right.
I end up with a little contingent out there of two or three carts of assistant coaches or athletes. I will tell you that here at Wichita State right now, we have got, I don't know, 8 guys and gals that are serious golfers, like pretty darn into golf, really good golfers. And so they come out and they'll kind of caddy for me and follow me around. And some of them will play some holes with me. And it's fun. That's fun.
Yeah, I love that. I love uniqueness. I love challenging yourself. I'm so glad. I think you said your name was Jenny. Talked to you off the 50 miler. I wish she would have talked to you off of the 30 mile. That's also crazy. I love how you're a guy who's never done a marathon, but you've done 30 and 35 miles. That's just, that doesn't exist in this world, but of course it does with you. All right, Bolt, wrap us up today. You've been at Wichita State now for 24 years. We're not rooting for, actually, I am rooting for retirement because I think you deserve. I was just talking to someone else about retirement, a coach, and I was like, you know, selfishly, I say I never want you to retire because I love having you in the profession. But I also truly believe you deserve to retire for your family, for your own personal sake, etc. However, that's not coming up anytime in this season. So what's got you excited as you look forward to whether you dictate what the future looks like, whether it's this season, next season, three seasons, what's got you excited about Shocker track and field?
I'm still enjoying coaching these athletes. I love our athletes. I love the team aspect of track and field. I am not excited about a lot of different things that are happening in college athletics right now. That would be a whole nother podcast, but I am excited about Wichita State, our team, in the American Athletic Conference. It's a good conference. I love the coaches and the teams in our conference, and I enjoy getting around to the conference meets and I will tell you that this, you know, the high jump has been my lifelong love affair, and the multi-events have been my lifelong mistress. And it's just been, I truly have loved those events, and those are the events that I coach. I help out with the hurdles on our staff, but I am in charge of the multi-events and the high jump. And I'm really enjoying coaching those athletes. And so it gets me excited to think about, rolling on forward until I retire with the athletes I'm coaching and others that we've already recruited in those events and all that. So I'm really enjoying this.
And, you know, here at Gill, you know, our CEO has a famous saying. I talked about George Williams' famous saying. I've kind of adopted as my own mantra here, healthy things grow. Things are growing at Wichita State. You mentioned the state meet. And, when you're listening to this, you're probably listening to this in May of 2024. April and May, we have a bonus series that we're doing where we interview one coach from every state to talk about their outdoor state meet. And you might want to go back and listen to the Kansas state meet because it is a lot of tradition, a lot of history that happens there. You guys, Cessna Stadium here it's getting a redo, a much needed and deserved redo. We're going to have a whole new complex there as well. So healthy things grow. So that's got to have you excited.
I hope that this project they're going to do it in phases in order to make sure that we're always ready every May for the state track meet. And so I'm not sure how those phases are going to go. I hope that they go, you know, 1 year, you know, if it's a 3 year period of time, then I'm looking forward to being able to coach in this facility, in our new facility for at least a year. If it's a lot longer than that, if it takes a lot longer than that to raise all the funds, so does, you know what I mean? Then I don't know if I'll ever get to coach in this new facility.
Maybe you just have to golf more.
Keep it going. That's right.
100 holes, baby. Let's go. Well, Steve, thank you so much. You know, again, this is not, I've said this over and over, it's not an easy podcast to be on because this isn't a 20-minute podcast. We get real deep here. And I think, you know, you actually hit the nail on the head here. We could, you know, this is about a 2 hour. We could gone 4 or 6 hours because you are, I said it from the very beginning, you're the king of stories, not only because you live a lot of them, but you tell them so well. So I'm just so grateful for you. I had a blast. You know, anytime I get to talk about my mentor, Fred Dixon, is always, that's an amazing time. We've had Harry Mayer on here as well. Just, you know, that decathlon history is really, it's really fascinating, actually. And, you know, your history with Gary Pepin and Bob Timmons, I mean, it's really just amazing. I think there's a lot of lessons that are in there. And so just thankful for your time. It means a lot to me. You're getting ready for conference and nationals and regionals and everything while trying to get a project going and still running a program. So grateful for your time. That means the world to me.
Well, I want you to know that I really appreciate you doing this. I think it's fabulous. I think it's a wonderful service to the coaching community. And so I admire what you're doing a lot. And I always love seeing you when we get a chance at the national or at the convention or wherever we track meets that we cross paths. And so thank you for all that you do for college track and field.
Absolutely. You deserve it, man. You deserve it. All right, everybody. Thank you for being here. Really do appreciate you again plugging in. These coaches deserve it. I think, you know, this is another great example of a coach who, what an amazing history. You know, I think this might be the first, I think, yeah, you can excuse my memory after 250 episodes, but this might be the first coach on here that as a, you know, as young as a fifth grader was like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a coach. And then lived it out. I mean, we, you know, when I was in fifth grade, I said, I want to be an astronaut and I did not live that out. Probably better that way for all of us here. So, just great to hear his story and think there was a lot of life lessons out there for you. So join us next week. We'll do it all over again. As we're getting close to the NCAA championships, these championship seasons, the best time of the year. Thanks everybody. Have a great day.
The goal to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking the growth. Gotta prep before you carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to the goal. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. Can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience, you can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. Till we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach could be a blessing.